God, I hope my parents don't listen to this podcast because they have no idea of what I've done in my life. They wouldn't know half of these stories.
I'm Matt Levinson. My guest today has an incredible story that's taken her around the world a bunch of times. On what seems like pretty much the flick of a coin, Brooke Webb is larger than life. She's the chief executive of the Sydney Writers Festival, which is just about to kick off, a member of the board of the State Library of New South Wales. So as a book lover, I'm immediately interested. But actually, it's her own story I'm most captivated by here. As we sat having coffee together late last year, she mentioned touring Sonic Youth and Bon Iver around the States, working on Mel Brooks, the producers, taking Cirque du Soleil around the world and so much else. And I thought, hold on, I really need my recorder. So here we are. That's what this podcast is about. The incredible stories behind people who make great things happen in our city, getting to know them and what made them the people that they are. Brooke, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Oh, thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me.
When I look at your story, there's this irrepressible drive to just try things out, a kind of one life to live urge that seems incredibly strong. When you look at your parents, even your grandparents, the people that were around when you were growing up, do you see any clues to the kind of person you are now?
Oh, God, that's a really good question. I think my parents, if I start with them, the thing about my parents is they were always so encouraging. As you know, as a little kid, I used to always love playing dress ups and creating this kind of sense of wonder, whether it be with Barbies or, you know, literally wanting to be a nurse. Or my parents were so encouraging and supportive and said, "You can do anything that you want to do." So there were no limits for me as a kid, which is a great starting point, teamed with the fact that my dad was in the Navy and my mum was an artist or is an artist. And so he worked on submarines. So we were the family that moved around every 6 months. So every 6 months, there's this new landscape, there's this new world that we inhabit. Mum paints landscapes, so you couldn't have anything that's more opposite. So, there was this no sense of, I can't do that, or that's out of my reach. So it was always a very creative childhood growing up.
Yeah, really interesting mix though, I imagine, because, you know, the defence kind of backgrounds, like there's a lot of discipline and structure to that, but also like changing location all the time and a creative mum. I can see some clues there.
Oh yeah, it's you bang on. And actually, as I'm older and wiser now, I see that's the kind of split personality of me. You know, it's the discipline, it's the rigor, it's the drive that you have to have. And then it's that balance with play, balance with the life force and bringing something to life, because that takes a lot of energy to be able to do that.
Was there a lot of that kind of creativity at home, painting and making stuff, that kind of thing?
All the time. All the time. My mum is probably one of the, you know, you talk about me being larger than life and I think, oh my God, that's my mum. He's talking about my mum. My mum just has this exuberance in everything that she does, and she brings a sense of fun to everything that she does. So growing up with my mum, who would also be playing dress ups, we'd be painting together, and I still paint with my mum. I think that's something that I'll always have. It's just, it's formed me.
For some kids, you know, being dragged around from, you know, base to base around the world, you know, as defence kids can be, you know, it can undo them in a way. They can, you know, sort of retreat into themselves, or they can, you know, struggle. And for other kids, they become the life of the, you know, the place. They become really outgoing and confident and good at making new connections. What was it like for you landing in a new school and landing in, you know, different towns and making new friends and all that kind of thing. Was that something that came easy or was it challenging?
I think it's always hindsight. At the time, like I remember, so I grew up in Darwin, I grew up in Cairns, I grew up in, you know, both a mixture of regional and metropolitan cities. I grew up in Victoria, I grew up in Melbourne, Adelaide, largely all along the east coast of Australia. But Darwin was particularly memorable for me because my sister, who's 3 years older than I was, you know, you grow up in Darwin and you don't know... There are not four seasons there. They have the wet and the dry season. So when we, you know, got wind that we were moving down to Melbourne, which couldn't be more of a polar opposite, to be honest, we'd never owned a jumper. And because we'd moved from Cairns to Darwin. And so this was like, you know, the early 80s. So mum was like, okay, I'm taking you jumper shopping. We'd never worn them. And they were so expensive that mum could afford one jumper. So my sister and I had to share a jumper as we were coming down in the car to Melbourne. We drove down and, you know, jumped on the train and a whole bunch of things and got to see so much of Australia. But I remember rocking up to school on the first day and hating it. The first day always sucked and my sister would hold my hand and she'd say, don't worry, we'll have lunch together. But then, you know, I think you meeting new friends and still being in touch with the old friends from previous schools, there's something about I got to learn people very, very well. And got to understand people in a way that, you know, people that haven't moved around as much as I have, you know, they talk about travel being so beneficial. You know, there's pros and cons. I'm still at a point in my life where I get itchy feet if I've been somewhere too long. Too long can be, you know, 3 years now, not 6 months, but I still get itchy feet and that sense of adventure and that sense of curiosity hasn't died.
Yeah, that is absolutely obvious in your path to get here. So it comes as no surprise. Back around that time, your first job was working in a news agency, is that right? Where was that?
Oh my gosh, you're good. That was in, where was that? It was in Canberra. So when my dad was... you know, kind of finishing up at the Navy, my parents made the decision that they would stop traveling while my sister and I were going through high school so that we could have some consistency. And I was in Canberra. So I was at a place called St. Clair's College, and it was the news agency close to where we lived, you know, and it was first job and then the body shop. I think that was where I did work experience, because back in those days you did work experience to get a full-time job or to get, you know, a job over Christmas. So I was working at the body shop.
As a kid, you didn't think of yourself as a creative person, which is surprising given all that you've just said about painting with your mum and the kind of creative environment that you were living in, and also all the wild and creative things that you've been involved with since then. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Sure. Gosh, I know I have said that at one point, and I probably would still say that about myself. Like, don't forget, I've spent a lifetime working with the most creative people, and, you know, inevitably you do kind of compare yourself with them. I think why I wouldn't consider it creative is because you don't really know any different. You don't really know how other families live or how other, you know, how other kids are kind of brought up. So it was always fun. It wasn't, and I always thought, I guess I had an understanding, or I thought that creativity meant genius, and it doesn't necessarily mean genius. But now I would consider creativity in a different frame. I would think of it as being equal discipline and equal being able to tell a story in whatever form that might take.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, those big things about writing particularly. You know, we're going to be talking about, you know, eventually in this conversation about your role with the Writers Festival. I just finished a book, I'm running at the moment, and I just finished a book by Murakami about running, and in it he's sort of like drawing these comparisons between running and writing and just the discipline involved in writing every day, and so many writers will talk about this. I guess that balance of the creative genius and the kind of insight, but also the just hard work and getting to work in the day.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. And we've got a lot to talk about, Matt. Like, I couldn't agree more. And it's only in the last 5 years that I would say discipline has come into my vocab when I talk about creativity, because it's a real drive, and it's a real, in my experience, it's been a real drive, and it's hard work. You've seen memes where it's this drawing of what creativity looks like, and it's not a straight line. It's a mess on a page. You know, that's kind of the state of the brain. I don't know that. There's something about not ever feeling really like you've landed it. You keep pushing and you keep pushing. That's I think certainly true of all the artists, whether it be musicians or writers or fashion designers that I've worked with, you know, that they keep pushing. They are always trying to take it to the next level.
You were in Canberra, you know, I guess this is in your teens, getting a sort of a stable finish to school. And the next thing that I can find is you're in Glasgow in the, you know, in the late 90s, working on the festival there. How did that happen? How did you sort of get from Canberra to Glasgow?
Oh, gosh. Matt, who are you? How do you know all of this stuff? I was a teenager growing up in Canberra at the time. So this is like early 90s. I'd just seen a band called Nirvana, and I was with my kind of first boyfriend at the time, and we'd, you know, there's the ANU Union, like, bar. We'd been there. This band no one had ever heard of, but, like, you couldn't get a ticket. We found a broken window, and he was like, let's crawl inside here. And as we were crawling in, we were actually crawling onto the stage, and I remember seeing Dave Grohl's calf. He had one calf that was massive because it was so it was his drumming calf, and then, you know, this other skinny little leg, and we got thrown into the audience, and I was like, oh my god, this is life, this is living. And Canberra was a pretty sleepy town growing up. You know, my parents used to say it's a great place to bring up a family, and they're not wrong. I just wanted more. I just knew that there was more out there, and I think every point in someone's life, you get that burning feeling. So I did 1 year at ANU. I was studying arts law. I was so restless, particularly, like, law was really interesting. It's something that we should all be taught at school, just basic legal principles.
How the system works.
Yeah, that's right. And that was really interesting. But I wanted to talk. I wanted conversations. I wanted to play. And so I did that backpacking thing where I went to London, and within like 3 days of being in London, I was in Oz Court, or Earl's Court as it's known. And I was like, God, this is just like another city in Australia.
It was such a rite of passage around then, right?
Yeah, 100%. And I decided on my fourth day that I was going to get a cheap flight to Tel Aviv. And I was 17 at the time, so I was quite young. And I thought it would be a really great adventure. Got to Israel, to Tel Aviv, and realized it was a really expensive city to live. And didn't really have enough money, so had to get a job. And ended up working with a Israeli rock star as his EA, moved to Jerusalem, and don't know why Israel, pulled me at the time, but it was just something so different to what I was used to. And I ended up staying in Israel for about 3 months, got myself back to London, and thought I'd move to Edinburgh. So I moved to Edinburgh, and there I worked in a coffee shop before I kind of got my first serious job, I guess you could say, at the Edinburgh Arts Festival. So I was working there as their office manager, and this was 1993, I think.
That was your first taste, and this whole story, this whole answer to that question feels like such a classic Brooke answer to a situation like this, and so kind of characteristic of the journey you've been on since then. But was there anything about that festival that you worked on then that grabbed you? Because, I mean, that's one of the world's great festivals, right?
Yeah.
Did it kind of get its teeth into you right then and there?
Oh, my God, it so did. And I remember more about that period of my life than I can tell you about what happened in the last year for me. So combination of two things. One, I came across an artist called Daniel Lepage, who was premiering at the festival that year. Also, Cillian Murphy and Disco Pigs was in that period. So I was seeing some of the most mind-blowing productions that I never thought was possible. This kind of just blew my brain. The other side of that, of course, like with the arts festival, you've got the Fringe Festival, and you're seeing, you know, it's Edinburgh comes alive, and I think there's like 500 shows in the Fringe. You're also seeing how hard actors, artists are working to promote their shows, to get audiences, and how much they believe in what they do. So I was seeing both sides of that, and there was a passion there that really spoke to me, and it just grabbed me.
How long did you stay there for?
I was in Edinburgh for 2 years, and then I moved to Prague because I wanted to study puppetry. At the time, there was this group there, and they were making UV puppets. And again, that just kind of blew my brain. I just thought, this is so exciting. And I just want to know more about it. I was so curious. So I was studying puppet making and puppeteering in Prague. And then I did the journey around Europe backpacking, you know, to make money. I was doing things like working in a bar or largely coffee shops, but also I was learning massage therapy because, you know, somewhere along the line, someone had told me that you can make a ton of money being a masseuse. That really didn't appeal to me that much, but I was, you know, trying all different things, and I was just testing the boundaries to see what fit for me.
Yeah, I guess for a lot of people, you know, you're like 19, 20 at this time.
Yeah.
You know, you might have still been at ANU being part of a puppetry club and working in a cafe in, you know, in Civic or something. Yeah. Instead, you're doing it in Prague and traveling around Europe, which sounds infinitely more exciting, having spent some time in Canberra and having a lot of love for the place still, you know.
100%. And, you know, as I'm saying all of this, I'm like, God, I hope my parents don't listen to this podcast because they have no idea of what I've done in my life. They wouldn't know half of these stories. But, you know, I do remember calling them when I was in Tel Aviv, and Mum and Dad were like, "How's London?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm not in London at the moment. I'm in Tel Aviv. I'm about to head to Jerusalem." And they're like, "No, you're not, Miss Webb." And I am. Bye. You know, my poor parents, I just put them through hell. But I was fine. Like, I never felt unsafe in the world. I never felt that the world was unsafe. I always, you know, I was cautious and all the things. But again, you test the boundaries. That's what you do.
You wound up working in Tokyo eventually, working in robotics.
Yeah, well, yeah, I was, I came back to Australia after, I think, 4 years away, and my parents were still in Canberra. I got back to Canberra, and I just didn't fit there anymore. So I moved to Melbourne and didn't know anyone in Melbourne. My mum, her sister lived there, who I ended up staying with, I think, for a month or something to get to kind of find my bearings. And I was able to get a job in a publishing house called, Black Ink. And it was Newsweek at the time. They used to publish a magazine called Newsweek. So I was working as the receptionist there. And then within a couple of months, I was asked if I would like to be part of the editorial team. And part of that job meant promoting the books that you were working on. And I was working on kind of topical nonfiction books, architecture books, beautiful photography books. And through that network, I met someone who worked at Sony and said, "I want to hire you to be a publicist to work in PR." And I was like, "Oh, wow. Okay, great. It's not a path that I saw for myself. I think the kicker was that the job would take place in Tokyo. So I moved to Tokyo, and I think I was 23 at the time, moved to Tokyo and worked there in their publicity team. And my product was the Aibo. So kind of back in the 90s, Sony had a product called Aibo, and it was a robotic dog. AI and robotics at this time was scary for people. So when you were fronting journalists, the first things you would say is that computers are not taking over the world. You know, like AI, it's such a different environment now. But you used to be able to kind of teach Aibo how to live in the world through positive or negative reinforcement. And if you've seen Bicentennial Man, which is the Robin Williams film, Aibo is all through that. So that was like my first kind of groundbreaking achievement in that role. I was able to get it a mass kind of promotional opportunity in a big feature film. And from that moment, Aibo just took off. And Sony actually changed a lot about their strategic direction. They were putting a lot of money into Grand Prix racing at the time, and they kind of withdrew all of that and put it all into AI and robotics because they saw this future of, you know, even things like fire rescue and helping elderly people and et cetera. So, yeah, that was kind of at the very ground floor of AI as we know it now, I think.
I mean, I guess for a lot of people that could be a career, you know, working in Tokyo, working with a massive global corporation like Sony. Instead, you were like back in Melbourne pretty quickly working for the National Trust, kind of in a media comms kind of situation again. So a little bit of continuity there, but you know, back in Melbourne, what brought you back?
The honest truth is that I had burnout. I didn't know what burnout was. I just knew that, you know, I was 23 and I was in a very high pressured role. And it was taking the joy out of life. I was working so hard and so much. And I guess if there's one thing to take away is that this, you know, my life looks like it was this kind of easy ride. The hard work that it took, because you're coming into roles that you don't, at that time I had no experience. I really didn't know what I was doing and I had to figure it out. And you know, there was a lot of failure along the way, and that kind of inner critic of myself was, you know, kind of beating myself up. So I'd work harder and I'd work harder, and it was this thing to prove myself that I could do it and learn. So I was learning on the job at the time, and there are a lot of kind of measures of achieving, because the roles I've had have often been really high profile. So I just worked myself into the bone, and at 23, having burnout wasn't great. So I, and I didn't, you know, I was a foreigner living in Japan, living in Tokyo, great city, blew my brain in so many ways, but I didn't know anyone. So I didn't have that network of support apart from colleagues that I worked with. And I think at that time I was also mindful that life, I was getting older. You know, I was in these really serious roles. First time I started thinking about, well, what does life balance mean? So I returned to Melbourne, and took a job there in the National Trust as their head of comms and PR. And I was editing their monthly magazine. So then, you know, the National Trust is a not-for-profit, organization heavily funded by all of their members, and we were putting on events directly for them. They were a really poor organization, really underfunded. So one of the things they have, you look at what they have, and I guess what I'd learned from Sony was look at what your assets are. And they have this incredible portfolio of property. So was able to work with Film Victoria to get some of these properties in film, which was a bursting scene at that time. You had Ned Kelly being produced. I think Moulin Rouge was being produced. Not that we got a property in Moulin Rouge, but we did certainly get one in Ned Kelly and The Bank, which was another one. And that was bringing in, you know, the most amount of revenue the National Trust had seen in a while. So, again, that was it was something I was quite proud of at the time. But through that and working in film, I realized that I wanted a little bit more for my life. So I auditioned for NIDA, and not the acting course. NIDA at the time had a directing course.
Theatre directing, yeah.
Yeah. And they, you know, famously you're told that like 1,800 people apply for NIDA in the directing course and they take 6 people. And so I put my hand up first time and I received notice, like John Clark, who was the administrator at the time, called me and said, "You've come 7th." And I was like, "Huh?" And he said, "So we encourage you to apply the following year." And I was like, but I really want to do it. And so I actually took some time off from the National Trust and moved over to Paris for a while. Again, no plan. I had, you know, so little money. I mean, if it was in the same position now, I don't think it's something that I would have done. But I just knew I'd be fine. And I was. I landed on my feet and got to understand. I spent a lot of time at this club in Paris called the Elysee Montmartre. I saw the Roots play with Jill Scott, and they filmed, they recorded their famous song there, which is on an album. And it was just this world that I kind of lived in for about 4 or 5 months.
It's so interesting, you know, you were feeling burnt out in Tokyo. So you return back to Melbourne to, I guess, gather your wits. And you go into actually a super contentious role, like with, you know, like the National Trust can be contentious at times. You were all over the media. Like that's probably the period of your career where there's the most media coverage and you're kind of quoted all the time. You start doing a theatre directing course. You move to Paris. Like this is not kind of what, you know, your typical person does when they sort of like kick really? Back from, you know, from a burnout, right?
You
like, they might sort of like land on the couch and, you know, be stuck in front of Netflix for a while.
Oh, really? Oh, that, I must try that sometime. Yeah, look, I don't know. I know. It's weird because I look back on it now and it doesn't even feel like me anymore. But yeah, it was just, I had a lot of energy when I was a kid, but also I had something that it couldn't be, it's like a hunger that couldn't be stopped. So, and again, this freedom was divine. It was fuel. So when I came back,
I actually wonder whether, you know, having traveled so much as a kid, having moved around, where some other people, when they want to kick back, they want to just stay in the one place. Actually, for you, your kicking back is getting out into and having an adventure of some sort.
And maybe there's something in, you know, having this clean slate and having this new world to discover. Because that's kind of what I was used to, this stimulation. It was this constant stimulation as a kid, all the time.
Around this time, you wound up with this just incredible kind of series of productions that you were involved with, the producers, Grease, Cats, Billy Elliot. You know, what stands out for you from that time? This, it feels like it must have been just a massive rush of experiences.
Yeah, it was. It was, I think everything I've done, you know, in life, it's always been a steep progression from the last thing that I've done. I went to NIDA the following year. I studied theatre directing there and then was fortunate enough to work with Mel Brooks on The Producers over in Broadway, and that was a relatively new show at the time. Was working on it here in Australia with Gordon Frost, then worked with Julie Taymor on The Lion King in Broadway, and then worked with, David Gilmour on Grease, but I was working in the casting section of Grease, so that was on the West End in London. And it was through that community of people that I met a man by the name of Pierre Veneuf, who was the creative director at Cirque du Soleil. And he invited me to come and speak with him in Montreal, which I did. And then 3 days later, I'd been offered a role as the artistic director at Cirque. Now, at the time, I was 27 when this, I was the youngest artistic director that Cirque had had, and it was a really interesting time for Cirque. So it's not the Cirque that we know today. It was 20 years ago when it was still very much the Heartland Circus group.
And sort of big top shows, that kind of thing, yeah.
Big top shows, the Grand Chapiteau, and we were part of where Cirque was at was that they were so famous around the world, they'd exhausted their audience, but there was all these what they call B and C and D markets that they hadn't been able to get to. So they were looking at transferring. Part of what I came in to do was to help them transfer from the Grand Chapiteau, which is the Big Top. And the Big Top touring is extraordinary. Because circus is third, fourth generation family. It's family skills, and you're often traveling with families. So there's a school. And when you're in Italy, they're not Googling the Sistine Chapel. They're taking excursions out to the Sistine Chapel. So these kids learn every language of every country that we go to, and you see how quickly kids soak all of this up. And then, you know, you're staying in places for 3 months. So we were in Korea, we were in Argentina, we were in every 3 months we were moving to some place in the world at the same time, working on a tour which started in Canada and then the US, of taking it into arenas so that we were hitting more and more audiences. So I got to see every nook and cranny of Canada and the US, and as we all know, the US is a very different country when you take out the big metropolitan cities. So take out New York and San Fran and even Seattle. Regional America is a really different place. So that was, you know, a really different style of touring. We were moving to a new city every week. We couldn't tour with families in the same way, so it changed the composition of the shows that we could do, because you know, you can't take kids any at this point. And it was a much more rigorous style of touring. So you needed more physios and more people on tour. So it was changing all of the setup of that tour. And it was, so I kind of came in and for the first 2 years worked on Grand Chapiteau, you know, and got to experience countries and places and understand circus, the real heart of what circus is. And then you're taking it out on the road, and it was like a conveyor belt, and it was exhausting. It was exhausting. And at one point at Cirque, I had three different shows, which were in three different places in the world. And so as the artistic director, I'm working with the touring director, and I'm looking after the show, making sure it's got integrity and quality, making sure that artists are fine. And, you know, we've got 88 artists per show. So it's a lot of people that you're dealing with. When you've got three shows at any one time in three different places in the world, you can imagine how taxing that is. You're also dealing with people that English isn't their first language. So there was a rule on tour at Cirque that English was the language that you speak. But, you know, where communication is so important, and we're learning how to communicate with each other in different languages and different styles. So it was this world that you lived in was unlike any other. You know, you go back into the real world when you had breaks, and it was such a different adjustment. It's a bubble that you're living in.
It's funny, when I thought about this, you know, like, for a lot of people, running away and joining the circus is like, you know, things are crazy, I hate my family, that kind of thing. But for you, you know, in a way, your life had kind of uniquely prepared you for, like, this is kind of a totally natural thing for you to do in a way. When I looked at your CV, like, actually, this seems like one of the longest stints you've spent anywhere. It must have been a really, like, challenging, but also rewarding and satisfying experience for you. Like, can you talk about why it sustained itself for you for so long?
I think you've really nailed it. It was deeply challenging in a way that I hadn't known. I had a level of maturity at this point to start figuring out what I was really good at and what I needed to learn more about. And I started to see, my God, this is a career. This could be a career. I was in such a serious role. You're working with lives up there on the stage and constant injuries. Cirque have had deaths in their time, and no one teaches you how to deal with that and manage a team of people. You know, when you're performing on stage, for a circus performer, it's fun and games until they see someone get hurt. It's the psychology of how do you work with that. It was a deeply consuming space, but I was so proud of being at Cirque. I was proud of what we were working together as a group on. I was proud, and I loved the fact that I didn't have a home. So whenever I had a break, and it sounds excessive, but every 10 weeks you would get a 2-week break at Cirque. But believe you me, by week 9, you're crawling to that finish line. And I, at the time, owned a place in Tulum, Mexico, which no one had heard of, and it was this beautiful jewel on the Caribbean. It was this most rustic little shack. So I got to kind of go and decompress and disconnect from the world and scuba dive. And this was my life, you know, and swing by New York, see the latest gallery. And I mean, this sounds so privileged. It absolutely does. And it really was. I don't want to say, though, it was hard work. It wasn't a 9-to-5 job, as you would imagine. It was 24/7, 7 days a week.
I guess about 15 years ago, you gave that up and you wound up in New York. You know, it seems like at a bit of a loss, like what do I do next? And you decided you wanted to become a vegan chef. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I was, again, I'd hit burnout by the time I had resigned from Cirque, and it was a long process of finding someone a replacement. So I was, I think it was another 6 or 7 months before I left the role. And all I knew was that I needed to move to New York, like that I was going to move to New York. And so it was this moment of, I have enough money to go and buy myself a house, put, you know, a deposit for a house in Australia, or I can spend a year in New York, not worry about money. And of course that's what I chose, and it was the best thing I've ever done, because it was another change in my path. But all I knew at that point, that burnout was so strong. It took me about 3 months, 4 months at this point. I was 31 to recover from this. When you're on tour, it's really hard to take care of yourself. So I went the other extreme.
It sounds like you were taking care of everyone else, right?
100%. You were taking care of the artists, the show. You came third. And so I was absolutely adamant that I was going to take the very best care of myself, which meant getting a personal trainer, being vegan. At the time, raw foods were really big in New York. And this is like 2011. So it hadn't hit Australia at that point. Like, it's a thing here now. But so I went to the Natural Gourmet Institute and enrolled. If I was going to be a vegan and eat well, I love food, I was going to learn how to cook properly, cook being inverted commas, because it was mostly raw foods. But I didn't want to just eat lentils. So I wanted to do it properly and learn how to look after myself. And there I learned about local seasonal foods. It was this big kind of scene that was happening in Brooklyn. I cut all my hair off. In fact, I shaved my hair off and started working in a co-op, and then became a short order chef in a vegan cafe.
And that, again, like, could have been like a whole life, right? Like, you could have, you know, there are a lot of people who make a great life doing that kind of stuff in New York. But it all changed again for you, like, in a moment. And this is the moment when we were having a coffee last year, when I was just like, hang on, I need to have a recorder and, you know, get right into this. You were walking down the street, waiting at the traffic lights, bumped into someone and were talking to them about, like, what you need to do to stabilize your existence in New York. You need to write a CV. You needed to do all this sort of stuff. Tell me about that. How did...
That's so... I know, it was... New York was magical for me. I, you know, there's this whole philosophy about being so high vibe. I was so fit and healthy in every possible sense that New York was a playground for me, and it's one of the most welcome. I found New York to be one of the most welcoming places. It's like a giant orphanage, really friendly. And I was walking down, I think it was like First Avenue in the Lower East Side, and I had this epiphany that, you know what? My visa was coming up close to renewal, and I went, I've made this decision. I don't want to leave New York. It's not time yet. So at that same thought, I was like, well, I'll need to find a job. And pulled up to the traffic lights, and there was a lady next to me who asked me the time or something, and we ended up getting into a conversation. And I said, she said, are you... where are you from? And I said, she thought I was from the UK. And I said, no, I'm Australian, but I've been living here. I'm looking for work, actually, at the moment. I've just decided I'm not going to leave. I said, but it's been years since I've done a resume. And she's like, well, actually, I work in HR. So why don't we, I'm really happy to help you. Like, why don't you come over and we can work on your resume? So I was like, great. And she lived like two blocks away from me. We spent 3 days or three nights together. And on the fifth night, she was in a bar and she overheard someone on the phone who turned out to be someone very important in my life. He worked at Universal Music, and he was clearly in some kind of fight with someone on the phone, and fired this person. And my friend stepped in and said, is everything okay? And he's like, I need to find someone that can tour. And because I'd spent 3 days working with her.
She'd had a boot camp on your CV.
100%. So I got this call saying, come and meet me at the pub. And I went down to meet her, and instead I met this gentleman by the name of Peter, and he'd been briefed on me. I had no idea who he was. And he's like, tell me what you do. And I said, I'm a vegan short order chef.
Yeah, you coming in thinking he's, you know, maybe like wants to open a new vegan restaurant or something. Yeah.
Oh, I just thought they were friends, you know, that they'd met, and I was meeting someone new. And he's like, what else do you do? And I said, oh, I worked at the co-op, you know, in the East Village. What else? And I said, oh, before that I was at Cirque du Soleil. And he's like, tell me more about that. And then he offered me a job at Universal, and I was at this point in my life, you have to understand, after being on tour for so long and not having a home, having a home was amazing for me. I had a gorgeous little place in the East Village that was a sanctuary. So I was not at all interested in going back out on tour. That was not in my plan. He thought I was kind of playing hard to get, so he kept doubling my salary. And it got to a point where I was like, this is ridiculous. I can't turn this job down because, you know, I could work in this job for about 8 months and then figure the rest of it out.
And open it got your me own the visa. Restaurant.
Yeah, 100%. So I did. I started working at Universal, and I was coordinating tours. And basically the position description was, we're gonna give you, I think it was 5 million. You've done the job when you've made 15. It was kind of quite clear. So it was a matter of finding tours and taking them, booking tours, running the concerts and touring division through the US. And I worked with a bucket load of bands, bands that were not just necessarily bands that I loved, but bands that had a real audience and hadn't toured. So there was a commercial appeal to that. And the thing about working at Universal, and I'd learned this at Cirque as well, is that it's really commercial. So I had the good fortune of working with people like Sonic Youth. I'd worked with Bon Iver. I worked with there's a lot of bands that people won't know. An Irish band called Celtic Thunder. And some of the things we were able to do, besides going out on like 98 show tours in 100 days and living on tour buses and, you know, playing everywhere from Radio City Music Hall to the Fox Theatre in Detroit or Louisiana, or, you know, just going back over that same tour route that I'd almost been with Cirque on, and seeing America in a different way, but with music, not with circus. And again, the discipline, this is when discipline hit me. Because I was 32 or 33 I remember with one tour being in a particular venue and just, you know, you're finishing work at 2 in the morning and you're up at 8 o'clock the next morning and you're on the entire time. And there's something about being show fit and being tour fit to be able to do that properly.
Did you feel like you were there? Because you'd had that time in New York to get your health in order, to eat a lot of, you know, natural food and all that kind of stuff and have that kind of time to recuperate.
Yeah, and I think so much about that period in New York was about anything that I consumed. So whether that be the books I read or the shows I was watching or the people I was talking to, it was all really nourishing stuff. You go back out on tour and it's almost the other extreme. You know, sleep is not your priority. Going back into that space where you're looking after cast and crew and making sure that and the audience, you know, that's becomes your priority. So at that point it was learning to split the difference and figure out you can't live in extremes. What's that middle ground?
You came back to Australia. Yeah. And I guess it must have felt like getting off that treadmill in a way. Was that another moment where you just need that time out? Is that the reason you come back to Australia?
Yeah, I think so. That's a really interesting observation. My life really is crazy. You don't often talk about the detail of your life, but I remember finishing the last tour. I knew it would be my last tour for Universal, getting dropped off at my apartment in the East Village and literally sleeping for like 27 hours that first minute I walked in the door. I hadn't been back to Australia in about 6 years. I hadn't seen my parents. We were emailing and things, and my sister was in Africa at the time. So I was ready. I felt the whistle blow. I was ready to go back to Australia and I didn't know where home would be. So I flew into Melbourne and I remember interviewing for a position. And at that time it was, I was being really honest and I just said, all I want to do is work. And the recruiter who was the head of the company at the time called me and said, I'm going to be really honest with you. You're not going to get work in Melbourne. It's too small a network. You got to go to Sydney. So 3 weeks later, I just spent, you know, oodles of money setting up an apartment in Melbourne. I sold everything. I packed up what I could in my car and I drove to Sydney. And I started working for an agency for about 3 months and realized they weren't really my people. And lo and behold, I was offered a role at the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah. And you spent the time at the Opera House working on some of their big programs, Vivid Live, Graphic Festival, Summer at the House, and some of those big shows in the forecourt. Pretty soon after that, you were recruited for a politically contentious role in Tassie as the director of the Taste of Tasmania Festival. It was under a lot of fire at that time. There was a sort of a sense that it was on the rocks as a festival, sort of fading a little bit. What had you learned that brought you to that role, or like what made you think I want to step into that role? Was it something that you put your hand up for, or was it something that someone tapped you on the shoulder for?
It was a combination of both. I had been sent the position description by a number of people and said you should consider this. I didn't know the festival at the time, and I actually hadn't been to Tassie.
You'd never been to Tasmania?
I'd never been to Tassie at that point. I worked at the Opera House. I worked with a lot of people that were from Tassie, and that was kind of enough for me. I was like, this place is going to be great. I think your description of the festival at the time was very kind. It was lifeless, and it was on its kind of last legs. I think there was something about the taste of Tassie, and I interviewed for the role. I was in Vietnam and I was doing it via Zoom, and it was a terrible internet connection, and I was so sure that I didn't get the gig. But there was something about that festival. I knew exactly how to bring it back to life. I knew what to do. And that kind of clarity doesn't come often, but I just knew how to get it to where it needed to be.
I love those moments of clarity when the solution is just so obvious to you. Tell me how that came to you.
I think I saw a blank canvas, and I saw a reflection of, oh my God, we have an opportunity to do something really fun and make some beauty in the world. And that was entirely what I did. I'd been influenced at this point by people like Fleur Wood, who is a friend of mine, and I see her as this kind of creative force at periods in my life where this kind of whimsical wonder that she created. And I really felt that I could see that come to life during this festival. So creating a world that existed around this festival, I always think that a festival is a living, breathing thing. It's the most dangerous thing you can do is a cut and paste with a festival. And there was it was this opportunity to bring something that didn't exist into life.
We're sitting here in the Sydney Writers Festival office. There's been clanking and scraping and all sorts of stuff right through while we've been chatting. You know, some construction going on. Obviously, the team is absolutely working like crazy to pull off the festival, which is coming up just around the corner.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, scaling up from the year-round kind of prep that goes on to the kind of, you know, turning it into a real festival that's going to have, you know, stacks of volunteers and, you know, thousands of people walking around the different sites. In 2021, you accepted this job running the Sydney Writers Festival, and, you know, it must have felt like a really weird job to take right in the middle of COVID, a time when, I guess, you know, we could all just jump on a Zoom and, you know, listen to our favourite writers, watch our favourite writers talk in real time, wherever they were around the world. But what was your challenge coming into it?
It's a really good question.
Really long question.
Well, I mean, and I feel like the answer might be quite short. It was a pinball during COVID. So don't forget, from 2021 to 2023, essentially, is we look at those as being the COVID years. It was understanding that fundraising was absolutely critical to the organisation. I think, like most arts orgs during COVID, you kind of fell to the knees, and we had the good fortune of having government support and injections of cash coming through. But the difficult time was when that money stopped, and having to also, you know, having ambitions to grow the business, having ambitions to broaden the program. So broadening the programming remit, so we were not just speaking to one audience, but we were speaking to multiple and very diverse communities across Sydney, making sure that we could maintain free programming, making sure that we were, I think part of it as well, the challenge has been that we're a small team, and that if someone is away sick or someone's got COVID, there is no backup for that person. So the first 2 years were actually about harvesting and getting that foundation right. I would probably even say the first 3 years, getting that foundation right, staying afloat. It was survival. And now it's, now COVID, that anxiety around COVID is not as strong as it was. You can start to focus and bring dreams to life again. And the ambition is definitely brewing. The struggle I have a little bit is there is not a lot of time to ideate. I've just issued a 5-year strategy, and for me, the idea of festivals right now, we're reading about it in the in all of the media. In a post-COVID world, a festival model isn't sustainable. Costs have gone up 40% and revenue's not keeping pace. So how do you create a sustainable model, and what does that look like year round? So that's and then building the dreams around that. So that's kind of where we are.
What is the need for festivals in this post-COVID era? Clearly the financials are more challenged than ever before. But what's the flip side of that? Like, why do we need them? Why do we need this one particularly?
Oh, gosh, because this is books need festivals, So, and we don't just focus on fiction, we focus on nonfiction. So we focus on ideas where really complex ideas get unpacked. They're an opportunity for people to come together with their friends and their family and listen to some of the most important voices of our times. I think the opportunity that a festival offers is you get the chance to bring out really big commercial authors, and you get to balance that with some of the most exciting new emerging authors that people wouldn't normally have a platform to go and see.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been really interesting, and obviously your career is just a roller coaster and an adventure in itself. Before I finish, I just want to ask you 3 quick questions. What's keeping you up at night right now?
My neighbours. Really literal answer. My neighbours are keeping me up at night right now. Honestly, things like the state of the world right now and what is happening in Gaza keeps me up at night. Yeah, it's pretty devastating what's happening over there.
Who else should I be speaking to?
Oh, Matt, that's a tough one. There's so many people, and yet not one name comes to mind. I'm reading, long overdue, but I'm reading Kim Gordon's memoir, Girl in a Band, at the moment. And after living on a tour bus with her for many months, I've forgotten, and I'm celebrating how honest she is. I find her I've always adored Kim Gordon, and I just think she's really interesting.
She is incredible. That is a really great reminder to me. I've got to read that as well.
It's a great book.
What gives you hope?
Oh, gosh. I was simple joys. Like, I was on the train coming to work yesterday, and I saw a guy at Central who saw someone on the train that he knew, and he started miming all of these really sweet things to this person. I couldn't see the other person. Humanity gives me hope.
I love that. I love that connection. That feeling that there's a real person over there,
Seeing a mum with their baby, and trying to entertain the baby. It's things like that remind you what's real in the world. There's that great quote by in The Little Prince that says, "The most important things are what you can't see." I agree.
Thank you so much for being part of this today. If people want to find out more about your work, where do you send them to? What's the best? I mean, obviously the Writers Festival, but anything else?
No, I would say the Writers Festival. It's a lot. All of us, the whole team, it's so important. We all have our fingerprints all through this one. So
this was produced and hosted by me, Matt Levinson. If you haven't heard the previous interviews in this series, I really recommend you dig back in. Previous editions with Belkis Yousafzai, the great architect, Megan Loader, who started FBI and Double J and a bunch of other cool things, and Topher Boehm, who runs Wildflower Brewery in Marrickville, all really great stories and worth digging back in. If you know someone who'd be interested in this podcast, please let them know about it. That's really the only way people will find out about a podcast like this. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks so much for being part of this, Brooke.
Thanks so much for having me, Matt.
I might have a story for you.